Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of Monuments, Museums and Mojitos. Hello.
Hello.
So we have another episode for you, of course, and we actually have a guest speaker today. Isn't that exciting?
Yay.
So Athena, if you would like to quickly introduce yourself.
My name is Athena. I am half Greek, half Iranian, born and raised in London. Spent some time in Iran studying, also moved to Greece to continue my studies.
She's a fellow alumni.
And then I kind of moved back to London, so kind of full circle.
Yeah, she also had to struggle going to Elefsina for one year.
The struggle was real.
Today we are actually drinking a cosmopolitan, which will make a lot of sense in a minute when we announce our topic for today.
It was not a very democratic decision because I wanted to drink vodka with energy boost juice.
Polly wanted like a 14-year-old underage drinking type drink, which we weren't really having a bar of.
Yeah, so basically we tried to prepare it last minute. I had to go to Lidl to buy the product.
Yeah, that's the key word here, Lidl.
Yeah, we love Lidl. No,
that's pretty much Aldi, my Australian people. We needed cranberry juice. We got cranberry, apple, blueberry, pumpkin, whatever.
Instead of orange extract, I bought an orange.
I think it's actually a grapefruit.
So Nikki and I went and saved the day and bought the actual ingredients. So
it's
we're having
nice.
A real cosmopolitan and it is worth it.
Yeah. It's nice. So gals, guys, what we're talking about today?
Placemaking.
What is that? Tell us. Oh, intriguing.
I thought we could potentially just start with like a question and kind of ask you all to think for a moment about your favorite city or a town or your favorite neighborhood, somewhere where you've kind of got some fond memories. Kind of hold that image in your head and just kind of give me a quick description of what it is.
Okay, so I really love Prague, especially like the old town square in Prague. I just think the architecture is amazing, the kind of cultural vibes and the local food and stuff is really great. I mean, it's quite touristy, so that's something that you have to take into account, but I just think like it's so unique with the history that they have there. Really great place to go.
I think for me is the last neighborhood I lived in Barcelona, Raval. Probably 70% of the time I was intoxicated there, but maybe because of the parties and one of my best friends was my neighbor, shout out Kim. Also the multicultural environment, basically it's a neighborhood where mainly Arab people live, and you have also one of the best museums in Barcelona there, the Contemporary Art Museum. It's full with young people who are there to socialize. And yeah, it was very difficult to sleep, for example. Like, there was always something happening. Often when I was coming back from work, there was always police. There were lots of, calling them narcopisos, which are like apartments where people were selling drugs. You have prostitutes also there that you can see. But in general, like, very interesting neighborhood, yeah.
Yeah, because it's not the one that you think of when you think of Barcelona. Yeah. Like, and people probably think of, like, the Gothic Quarter or, you know, the more kind of
And it's literally in the center of the city. It's in the center of Barcelona. Mm. And it's also a very good example of gentrification and placemaking, but we will touch upon that later.
I mean, for me, obviously I'm a bit biased, but I think one of my happiest places is Athens, only because it's just been a part of my life, like all through different stages of my life with different people. So particularly like the cobblestones path that goes around the Acropolis, and then kind of taking that walk up the Pnyx, which is a neighboring hill, which is where democracy was born, and like catching the August super moon a couple times from there, just with different people, friends, family. So yeah, that would be mine.
I would have to say mine is probably a suburb in Melbourne called Coburg. It is basically a multicultural suburb that was home to a lot of the Greek and Italian migrants in the 50s and 60s migration. Now alongside that demographic is a lot of Arab population and families with businesses. So it's like a really big amalgamation of cultures, particularly those three. And also it's kind of on the fringe of gentrification. It's kind of already started, but you can literally go there and be taken back to the 80s and 90s in terms of like shops and an architecture that still exists there. So like if you're ever nostalgic, just go to Coburg Mall. You'll be exactly in a place of how it was when it was in the 80s or 90s. So it's very nice, very nice.
I mean, if you kind of ask that question to different people, we kind of get a similar memories in terms of like, it could be like a public park that we enjoyed or like a high street that we used to go with our mum growing up. So basically what it is that is in common with all of these answers is that, you know, it's, they're infused with like our happiest memories or essentially some infused with like some relationships that we have with friends, family, community. And by extension, it could be like it's infused with our self-image and so like our identity, what we kind of know about ourselves, because a place is just so much more than just a piece of earth or a piece of land. It is essentially living connection to the past. So I think this is a cool segue into what placemaking is. And it's increasingly become like a buzzword within the development industry, particularly along with like sustainability, greening and everything. But essentially what placemaking does, what good placemaking does, is essentially make a place work in a way that makes people want to be there, want to spend time there, want to tell others about it, want to make people feel a certain ownership to a place, makes people want to feel comfortable there. And it's what makes a place memorable. Basically, what breathes a soul into a bland piece of space.
And often, in the last few years, we see how culture is used as a driving force behind placemaking initiatives. And that's why we are here, and that's why we're discussing this topic, how culture and heritage are shaping our places.
Heritage is like the collective legacy or like the full range of traditions, places, objects, cultures, both tangible and intangible, but also incorporates living heritage, which is still evolving as we speak today, which would kind of, I guess, interlace with the definition of culture as a living entity. Or the effort of preservation of culture is essentially kind of uncovering the spirit of a place, because there's this definition of a place that was given by, I think it was one of the advisors to the Global Heritage Fund, who described place as a vessel in which the spirit of a community is stored. And I think heritage poses an opportunity in terms of uncovering that spirit with that space and then using that as a focal point for future development or regeneration of an area.
Yeah, because I think everyone has kind of lived in a place where they don't really connect to it.
Exactly.
Like they just, it's just where they live. It's not, they don't feel that sense of home or that sense of place. Mm. And so this is kind of the expansion of like really feeling connected to somewhere, like feeling like it's your place and it's somewhere that you want to be.
Yeah. Also interesting to say is that culture can be defined in two ways, anthropological or aesthetic. Anthropologically speaking, culture refers to ways of living together, livelihood, languages, religion, customs, intangible culture, basically. Aesthetically, we speak about, let's say, the acts of creative people, arts, and institutions, like museums and so on. And we have to understand that cultural heritage is part of this conservative idea of culture, but meanwhile culture is basically like a movement, like it changes, like it's not static,
it's living, yeah, ongoing, evolving. Yeah,
so everything that you imagine, your language, your ethnicity, what you eat, how you communicate with your neighbors, that's culture. So this also plays a part in placemaking initiatives, while heritage on the other side is another force. It's a more standardized force of culture, but it's another force that is also used for regenerating neighborhoods and reviving cities.
And I think what's important to kind of take into account, so when we're talking about place, to kind of make a place is to kind of infuse it with like a communal spirit. But to kind of remake a heritage site or a historical place, it, you know, you need much more than that. You need to kind of find a way to reconcile its original use with the community's modern needs, which I think is at the crux of successful preservation of heritage in making it relevant for today. Because I mean, what we kind of see often is essentially heritage conservators who try to preserve a heritage site in vacuum and like almost like something that shouldn't be touched and just should be left as it is. Whereas, you know, then it just becomes irrelevant. So I think that would be the most important thing to think about, is how you make it relevant into the community's current needs today.
Yeah.
Which is why it should be such a communal effort. It should be through, people should be involved in all the stages.
Yeah, I think inclusivity is the real kind of key aspect to that, isn't it? It's not that kind of, oh, there's an art gallery, but it feels like a really exclusive place. You wouldn't be welcome there. Mm. It's about making an inclusive, welcoming place, but including the culture and the heritage in that and not making that kind of separate.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a good transition about your work.
Mm-hmm.
So what have you been doing, yeah, basically?
Yeah, so I mean, I actually wasn't aware of the term or discipline of placemaking until a couple of years ago when I started an internship with this big like regeneration urban development company in East London. And I was working under this amazing marketing manager who kind of took a non-traditional approach to marketing for developers, which was very much heritage-led and more like story narrative-led. So there was some hoarding that was covering the construction site. Hoarding is just these barriers that they use to cover a construction site. And as opposed to like traditional marketing jargon of like, oh, we're bringing so many houses, blah, blah, blah. The marketing manager suggested that we kind of present it as a gift to the community in terms of like maybe just creating like a like an informal history trail, kind of highlighting the stories of the area because it's got such rich industrial heritage. So then we kind of went on to work with a couple of historians to kind of uncover the stories, uncover 10 different stories and histories of the area. And then I went on to illustrate them. And then we just created some simple signage all around the site so that people could just take an hour out of their time and just follow. And it was really interesting to follow because there were people, again, it's an area of East London that's quite, there's a lot of mishmash of ethnicities and nationalities. And there are people who are completely unaware of what used to be in that, in their local area. And it was interesting to follow the engagement of a website that I created for it because throughout lockdown, you saw a huge spike, obviously, because of people going right for local walks. And we got emails like saying how much they appreciated learning about it. And they managed to get like a renewed sense of pride in their place. So that was kind of my introduction into the world of placemaking. And I think what I really like about it is that it's so multidisciplinary in nature, because obviously I come from like an art, design and culture background. And this is like the perfect way to kind of blend it all in. You get, you can make some amazing art commissions that respond to the heritage in the area. And also you can get community engagement and everything. So it's kind of got like a bit of everything in there.
Honestly, that's incredible.
So that's my experience. Just to touch on placemaking experience.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a really interesting project because we all know how I love to do my research for our podcast. And I was trying, like, placemaking isn't really something that I've been particularly familiar with. So I was trying to do some research, you know, do my best to be informed and ready for today. And a lot of what I came across was to do with real estate. Mm. It was to do with new ways of looking at making properties that aren't necessarily to sell to private owners, but for more for community. So they're like build to rent spaces so that people will stay there and make it their own a little bit more. That's a really nice kind of idea, but I was really struggling to see or to find information on the more cultural and heritage aspect of it. So a project like that kind of really shows how it can all be brought together.
Yeah, that's one of the difficult sides of placemaking, is that it, as you said, it's a buzzword. The articles that you found related to real estate, a lot of people are using placemaking just to increase the property values and to bring money into areas with strong potential.
So it's not actually coming from the communities and sectors of heritage and culture themselves. It's coming from real estate and development perspective.
It started like that, and now it's kind of, I guess, it's gaining momentum in different, in other disciplines as well. And I think developers are starting to realize how much of a socioeconomic viability that it can have just to kind of focus on the historic area, because that is what makes that unique identity, which is what people connect to essentially. And I think what's important also to know is that it is quite a long-term process, in that, you know, it's essentially starts after the construction workers have gone home and it's done, and people actually start taking ownership of the place after the development process is completed.
Yeah, but here maybe it's also interesting to discuss good and bad cases about how culture and heritage basically influence placemaking, because culture can foster gentrification often. Raval is a very good example, the neighborhood that I highlighted, but in the same time it can really foster regeneration in neighborhoods.
So it's a balance. What's the right balance? Yeah. Is there a balance?
Martina, do you have any good examples?
100%. There's one project that I really liked in East London, which is more like public art, but it was kind of like a perfect blend of public art, but also community engagement and participation, as well as being sensitive to the history of the area. So there's this development of a high street in East London that was essentially decimated during the Second World War and then kind of rebuilt afterwards, but in a very bland and like grey way, which is usually the case. And then during lockdown, where the government messaging was mainly like encouraging local shopping, there was like a commission to an architect studio to kind of revive the high street. And what they did was obviously their research in terms of the history of the area, which was a community of Bengali and Asian communities. who worked in like textiles and clothes manufacturing. So what they did was collect items of clothing that people didn't want, ideally like colorful ones with patterns and everything. So all from all around the community during lockdown, they completely transformed all the facades of the buildings based on these clothing.
Wow.
On the patterns. So it's like an explosion of color and pattern when you walk in. It's just something completely unexpected. And they got really good feedback from the community in that they just felt safer, even just from that splash of color. You know, they
wow.
They felt safer to take their kids out or leave them to play. And I think the way that they were sensitive to the history, it wasn't just some random piece of art, which sometimes you get, which is quite unfortunate. I think that was quite a successful idea.
Yeah, it sounds like that.
Yeah.
As you said, a piece of art, often city councils believe that they can revive a certain neighborhood by making some nice murals or graffiti. And often these graffitis or murals are made by people who are not even from the neighborhood, not related at all, or even foreign artists. And they beautify these places because the people have more disposable income. They are attracted to this vibe of artistic life, of alternative life. Because if you think about it, people, they don't want to live in a super organized cities. That's why neighborhoods at Exarch are super
attractive.
Yeah. Places like Ravao, this alternative
Coburg.
Yeah. They're super so often white, middle to upper class people, they're attracted to these areas, they come, and because of their taste and the activities they do, they kind of push away the local people who live there and who are one of the reasons why they got attracted to these areas. Yeah. And then the investors notice that often and they're like, oh, so white people go there. Why don't we build some new residential buildings? Why don't we buy a whole building and just refurbish it and make Airbnbs out of it?
Yeah. Which is a huge problem in major cities in Europe now, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Airbnb crisis.
Yeah.
In Athens, Barcelona.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Capital. Like, good luck trying to find an affordable apartment in Athens, Barcelona.
Yeah.
I'm sure other cities as well.
Yeah.
But it's really, really hard if you're a long-term resident.
Yeah. But it also has good examples.
Yeah, I was just going to say. So I'm going to give the example of Kypsali, which is one of the oldest urban areas in Athens. And it's actually an area where, because my grandparents lived there. So that was my main image of Athens growing up. So it started its urban transformation like in around the 1930s, where they started like neoclassical styles. And then after the 1930s, newer houses and apartment buildings were influenced by international trends like modernism and Bauhaus and Art Deco. And then in the 1960s, there was a huge influx of middle, upper middle class Greek families. That's when my grandparents moved there after the mass Greek exodus following the Egyptian revolution.
Oh.
So at that time, that was like one of the most up and coming areas to be in. And it had a huge thriving nightlife, theatres, bars, and basically housed a lot of artists, intellectuals, musicians, actors. So it was kind of like the go-to of the time. And then it slowly, once families started moving away further north, rents dropped. And around the 90s, there was a huge influx of immigrants from Africa and Asia and whatnot. And they kind of sort of started to, I guess, decline since then. And it's also kind of known as the urban jungle of Athens. But then what is really interesting is that now it's kind of started to reclaim its identity back in a way that obviously most of the immigrants who've been there for 30 plus years are now considered natives, and essentially the area is kind of leaning into its multi-ethnic nationality identity. And as a successful example of civic activism, there's like a municipal building within Kypsali, which was a beautiful neoclassical building from the 1930s that was used as the local fruit market. And then it started to get into decline, and then there was talk of demolition and replacing it with a monstrous multi-story parking lot next to... Next to Fokionos Negri. I know, right?
No.
Next to Fokionos Negri, which is one of the first pedestrianized areas in Athens. So why would you have... I mean, it makes no sense.
Oh my God.
So, and that's when the people decided they'd had enough. They took a stand and they just started hosting their own like exhibitions and community events and everything. So they literally took it into their own hands, and now it's actually the thriving hub of the whole area. So yeah, I mean, now it's proper up and coming. And what I love about it is that it's not a touristic place. It's very much like the heart of a nitty gritty Athenian local experience.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite a success story.
Yeah. I think Athens is a very interesting city in that sense. Like here you can still see this grassroots movement of protecting neighborhood vibe, or you have these local shops of people,
and they're everywhere, and there's so many of them.
Yeah.
I think like I've heard you probably say like, oh, Athens is becoming very gentrified. And yes, I agree. But honestly, I think there are such strong held pockets within the city that, I mean, might not stay as they are forever, but for at least a very long time.
Strong.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like places and shops and types of neighborhoods that don't exist in newer countries, say like Australia, which is something I adore about this city.
Yeah,
actually that's a good point, because you walk down any street in Athens and there'll probably be a traditional butcher's, greengrocer's, and there's still supermarkets here, like Lidl, obviously. Our sponsors for this for this episode. But yeah, like if you were walking down the same street in my hometown in Bournemouth, you would have to go to an artisanal kind of hipster butcher's to get your New Forest back bacon or whatever. Like it would be something for a gentrified audience. Expensive, whereas here it's the opposite. It's like the most accessible is just the normal person on the street.
I actually recently broke my slippers, and these are like my UGG Australian slippers. I was like devastated. I'm like, I can't find them in Greece. I found a bloody shoe repairman in my neighborhood who literally saved their soul for 4 euros.
I literally had almost the exact same story like 2 weeks ago. The heels of my like Dolly shoes completely disintegrated under my feet. It just decided it had enough. So I went to my local one and paid 5 euros and it's brand new.
I mean, like this shit does not exist in Australia.
Throw the shoes out and start again.
And that's culture. And that's why we need culture. It's not only about the heritage side or building an art institution. It's also about preserving the local cultural values.
Yeah, because actually when you think about the heritage in Athens, it kind of shows a different side to the story. Like with Plaka and how that was kind of decimated just to make way for the tourists. Because that used to be a very urban center, very affordable. Lots of families had lived there for a very long time, and then the government decided that they wanted to make more of the Acropolis, make more pedestrian areas, build the museum there, and they demolished a lot of houses, and you know, people just had to leave their homes for generations. So that's kind of it done badly. I mean, that was a good few years ago now. That was what, like 40 years ago maybe, like around the 70s, 50 years. But so that's the bad side of the coin, but then that was a stance from half a century ago, whereas now we're learning from mistakes like that and we're creating community spaces for the community and not just for incoming tourists.
Something that I think is really interesting about this topic is its ability to discuss and showcase and bring up particularly dark periods of places past. And I have a couple of examples in mind, but one of them that is at the forefront is, I don't know if you guys from England have heard of the Bricks and Mortals exhibition by UCL.
No.
It's basically a university-led initiative, UCL, who had some really problematic scholars at the time involved in a lot of eugenics. And basically, as a consequence, a lot of buildings and streets are named after these people. Mm-hmm. So streets that people take for granted, streets that campuses are held on, or rooms or buildings, are literally named after people involved in stuff like ethnic cleansing. So basically, Bricks and Mortals, what that has done, it's another tour, cultural route type thing that basically allows people to identify these places and see the stories behind these buildings' names. So suddenly you see this building that you've seen for ages called whatever this name is, but you actually see the flip side and the dark history behind it.
Usually what's lost.
Which is what's lost. And I think in especially a lot of colonial and ex-colonial countries, a lot of these histories are quietly swept under the rug. So to be able to bring in initiative that's tasteful but still tells the story of something that is problematic and troubling from a particular country is actually something quite good.
Yeah, that really kind of harks back to what we were saying in our statues episode.
Yes.
Of like removing the heritage altogether, or the, you know, the statues or what have you. Yeah, it's censoring. It doesn't explain what actually happened. Mm. It almost denies it even more, because it's not even there to look at. Mm. Whereas we could take a more educational approach.
yeah. and actually discuss this.
Exactly, because it's way better than pretending like something didn't exist. We don't like that.
No.
We don't. So yeah, I just think something that's interesting for me, and also something that is happening in Coburg, my place, is the use of dark spaces in placemaking, one of which is an old prison that has now been almost completely gentrified with apartment blocks, cafes, playgrounds. And it's just, it's a bit weird because this was a place, Pentridge Prison is the name, but this place basically had executions, was accused of inhumane treatment of prisoners. So many prisoners actually died there when they were incarcerated. Just absolutely traumatic shit. And now there's like a playground on the mustering ground.
I know, which is like, I said, I haven't quite made up my mind about how I feel about it. Because, I mean, obviously it is a perfectly functioning building, and it would be a shame to kind of, I don't know, demolish it and replace it. But then again, I quite believe in the energy of spaces and like, okay, well, how do you reconcile? How do you deal with that?
How do you?
Is, but at least it kind of generates conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's very true.
But yeah, like where there's now a cinema and Upmarket Wine Cellar is close to where 10 prisoners were executed. So it's like, I'm sure the cinema goer isn't necessarily interested nor wants to know about that.
Yeah.
But it's also important we don't forget about that. So it's that creative way of how do we present this in such spaces, I feel.
Yeah, authenticity. I mean, in its conventional definition, people, you know, we kind of tend to think of it as like a static,
like stuck like in the past, or like one,
like it never changes, like it never changes.
Yes.
It's like it's very much a product of like its time, snapshot. In a vacuum.
Yeah,
whereas I think that obviously it's something that develops with the people and with the community. And if we can't, obviously when preserving heritage or a historic site, obviously we strive to fit in to the current community needs. And I think that is also in itself an evolved authenticity. So it's not something that's just stuck.
Yeah, because like for our audience who aren't necessarily familiar with like the term of what we mean by authenticity, one example that was given to us on our collective university master's course is, say, at an ancient temple, you know, archaeological site, an earthquake happened 400 years ago and one of the pillars fell. Do you write the pillar again? Do you leave it as it is, toppled? Because if you write it again, then you're erasing the event 400 years ago. And why is that less authentic or less relevant than what happened 2,000 years ago? So, yeah, it's just something to take into consideration that none of these heritage sites are in a bubble of time. Like, it's not that this was a building that was built in this period and it has to stay true to that forevermore, because that's not the world we live in. There's always development. There's always new attitudes, sustainability, you know, new ways of thinking. Things aren't going to stay the same.
And for different people, authenticity means different things. Maybe for your local people, authenticity means cleaner neighborhood and buildings without graffiti. Maybe that's authenticity for them. Or maybe it isn't, you know. Maybe they want to keep the situation as it is now. So just, again, speak to your local people.
But a project like you were working on, Athena, sounds like it would be quite beneficial here. Yeah. To, like, kind of highlight the past.
I mean, like, what I'm currently now working on, because the history trail has come down now, the hoarding, I'm kind of thinking of, like, developing it in a way to... Because now that the first phase of the development is open, so there's like three listed heritage buildings and no explanations whatsoever. So people, now we've got residents and people who are actually using the spaces, and they actually have no idea what these buildings were.
No.
So I kind of want to develop that, walk into a more permanent signage to explain the story behind it, and potentially using like modern technologies like image recognition to kind of scan the illustration and make it come to life, something more interactive. Which can quite easily be done. Doesn't need a huge amount of, like, it doesn't need a huge budget or anything, but it's just like the thought behind it, really.
Yeah, I think especially in the UK, I mean, it happens in other places as well, but in the UK, a lot of people think heritage and they think of the old manor houses and cathedrals and museums. And those are, you know, wonderful, beautiful places to visit, but there's heritage on almost any street corner. Like, there's old warehouses, there's listed building, doesn't necessarily mean it used to belong to the Duke of Somerset. Like, it can be lots of different things.
Exactly.
And I think what's interesting, what another opportunity that placemaking kind of provides us with is by championing local heritage and like working with communities is a way to, you honor the local distinctiveness and the character of a place, but in a way, it makes it more accessible to people who wouldn't usually step into a museum or a gallery. So just by commissioning a piece of art that responds to a historic narrative of the place, people would be like, oh, okay, like, where does this idea come from? Where does this concept come from? And then it's exposing it to someone who would otherwise not be exposed to it at all. I think that's a huge...
Yeah, that's so powerful.
Yeah. One of the things that I did actually see with the kind of real estate projects was even they are investing in art in these public spaces. Mm. And it won't necessarily be the kind of art that's like a painting, but it might be a light installation that reflects the temperature. So everyone who's there in that public space on that day, they all feel the same temperature, so they all have the same experience, and
they're
the light
like part of the artwork essentially.
Exactly. It responds to the space and the people in the space rather than just being a prop art, like you were saying.
Yeah, just in a vacuum.
Can I be negative again?
Jew Polly.
So basically here the argument is that public art in public spaces can positively contribute to regeneration policies, right? Especially in achieving social benefits in this case, right? But that kind of brings an argument that government and businesses take more softer policies in engaging with social justice and adopt more softer policies in social inclusion, you know? Just putting a nice mural or a nice, without investing more in education or
local issues,
social inclusion, yeah, local issues that people face, is not going to solve our problems, you know?
Yeah.
Because, no. Investing in painting a nice mural and investing in a gallery may be an easier and, let's say, a cheaper approach than probably investing 4 years in education and trying to help people.
A local training.
Local training, yeah. Obviously, I'm a big advocate of placemaking. Placemaking is lovely. I think all of us agree on that. But we shouldn't use it also as a easy way to tackle serious problems, you know?
Or just another box to tick.
But I think in our societies, it's difficult for governments, well, for them to think outside of the box. And so it tends to be the people, the communities themselves, who'd start to make change. Like I did see one example of a community land trust, I think it was in Hastings, where basically like house prices had dropped in an area, it was kind of derelict. And so local people like artists and young professionals has banded together to buy large property developments themselves. They all put their money together to invest in making new apartments, and then they rent them at affordable prices for the locals. So that's something, it's something that, like, rather than a private corporation doing, it's members of the public doing that together to make a kind of more, more inclusive. Allotments are becoming very popular. Culture doesn't need to be about historical heritage site. I mean, that's our area of expertise, so that's what we mostly talk about. But it can also be community gardens, allotments, places that people can work on together and collaborate. And fostering that sense of community, which I think is has definitely been lacking in the last, well, in my lifetime, probably before that. Your parents always go on about like, oh, back in my day, there was such a community. No one locked their doors. We just go in and out of each other's houses.
Every country was communist or what? That's what my parents. That's what my parents were saying about communism. Oh, it was so great. It was, like, there were no issues.
Everyone had sugar to spare and lend it out to everyone else. But you know, that there was definitely a sense of community that we've lost. And I think in the Brexit age, there has been a tendency to blame that on maybe immigration or on like differences in language and culture, but that's not the root cause. It's about our attitudes. There's been proven studies, and this was to do with the real estate developers, so you know, they're interested in the money. They're not even like They don't really care about our ideals, our socialist ideals. But they could see that it wasn't the homogenous kind of wealthy urban suburbs that were the future. It's about making areas that have a vibrant community of immigrants, minorities, creativity, LGBTQ.
Yeah, this sounds so nice. No, it sounds amazing, right?
Yeah. Seriously, like, all of this just says one thing. Whoever you are, whoever's listening, like politicians, policymakers, like you might be there. engage with your community. Engage with your local community. Hear them out. What do they want? Listen to the people who make up the place you are working on or want to work on, and actually address their wants and needs.
Yes, yes. That's placemaking.
Mm. There was another good example of, again, a very simple, low-budget way of including community. For example, like the naming strategy of a new place. So there was this case study in East London around the Royal Docks, where the developer commissioned a kind of placemaking organization to host a series of workshops with the locals. So there were people of all ages who came in and shared stories of past, present, and future. And they kind of put it all together and into a neat little leaflet, into like a little booklet, and gave it back to the developers, which will now form the core of their naming strategy.
Which is just so lovely. It's easily done, super low budget. And, you know, these people will always feel that connection to it.
Yeah. But later generations, it'll be like, oh, my grandmother helped, be part of that.
Personal stories.
Can these people just try? Because look what happens. Just try. Just pretend to give a shit. Go out for a day or two. Speak to your people and see how easy it can be to incorporate their needs and wants into your strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully we've addressed the ups and the downs. Yes, we might be idealists, but if we don't try, then who's going to? So yeah, thank you for our TED Talk.
Coming to our TED Talk.
Athena, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and giving us your super valuable and interesting insights.
Oh, it's been super fun.
We haven't really delved into something like this before, but I think it's been such an interesting and fruitful discussion. So thank you.
It's been super fun. And it's just a lot of food for thought.
Yeah. And I think even though our listeners, this might not be something that they're used to us talking about, it actually probably affects them far more than any of the other topics that we've covered in the past, because it's about you in your local community doing something, making a difference.
Very much every day. So when, you know, when you're next taking a walk to your local high street or your local park, really try to think about what it is that you like about it or what it is that you don't like about it and why. Yeah.
And remember, everything's culture.
Everything is cultural and heritage.
You interacting with the local butcher of that works there for 20 years, that's culture. That's
or your
heritage.
Local fruit and vegetable shop.
Support them. Buy local.
Buy local. And also, again, this might be a bit idealistic, but also some practical advice. If you want something done to include yourself or your culture or your neighborhood, speak to your local member of parliament. Involve yourself in local policymaker. You are constituents. You can have a say.
Quote that this discussion kind of reminded me of this Austrian composer called Gustav Mahler. He says that tradition isn't the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire. Which I think is actually quite accurate, because it means that, you know, the ways that past eras have kind of developed their cities aren't consigned to to history in a way, and the how, you know, but they're like essential parts of our daily lives now, and development should kind of be emerging from this organic framework that already exists, building upon the past without being enslaved by it.
Again,
that balance of conserving what is best in our places without sacrificing the benefits of modernity.
Yeah, that's a really nice quote, because I like how fire is a living thing.
Exactly.
It's living, so it's changing. Really
win-win
nice
situation for developers, for heritage conservators. Everyone wins.
Yeah.
So that's placemaking. And again, thank you, Athena. It's been lovely having you.
It's been really nice being here.
And remember, guys, you can find us at Museums Mojitos on Twitter and Instagram, and at the podcast's full name on Facebook.
Yes.
Athena, how can we find you?
I have a website, just athenamogden.com, and Instagram, athenamogden.
Amazing.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
Bye.